Are you curious about, interested in, or working within the field of anesthesiology, and you are a woman, person of color, or otherwise do not fit the stereotypical image of what an anesthesiologist looks like, then this is the podcast for you. We will discuss what life is like on the other side of the blue drape for us. Issues most relevant, such as what is anesthesia really? And we're not talking textbook definition. Tips for applying, success in residency, life as an attending, and beyond. Join us each week as we take a dive into this rich and often misunderstood field. This is your host, Dr. Alicia Peterson, and welcome to SIVO Sistas. You all are in for a treat. I'm really excited about the podcast episodes we have lined up this month. I will be joined by Dr. Stephen Estime, a Black male, the first male we've had on this podcast since its inception, September 2022. And he's a trauma anesthesiologist, intensivist at the University of Chicago, who will be joining me on this podcast, tackling questions all this month. Today, he will be tackling the questions you have about finance. Now, he's not a certified financial planner, but has taken interest in personal finance, and his insights will make the intimidating topic of money during residency a little more digestible. Questions answered are, how do I handle student loans during residency? Should I buy a home near my training program? Should I seek a financial planner? And how do I prioritize my spending? Please enjoy.
Throughout this journey, you've acknowledged that, okay, yes, I have this passion for critical care, for trauma, for anesthesiology, but then I also like this other thing.
Well, you know, I will say that I am not a certified financial planner. I don't.
Oh yes, thanks for that
advice. You know, yeah. Get to this. So anything that I say, if you're broke, don't, you can't blame me for it. If you do get rich, I wouldn't mind a percent or two, but I legally cannot be obliged to hold any of that. You know, honestly, it was a lot of these philosophies that I sort of grew up with. You know, I think being someone who was sort of born and raised outside of Detroit. Family were nurses. For a long time, we were just supported. There was, you know, five of us, my two other brothers and my dad was going through school. My mom was just a registered nurse, and she was supporting us on her salary for most of my life. And so what that meant is that we needed to be really, really thoughtful about where we were going to spend our money. And you know, both my dad growing up in Haiti, you know, that was always a big concern of his as well, too, is where, you know, how are ends going to be met? My mom, same thing. She was raised very blue collar. And it was always just where, you know, we have to be very, very thoughtful about how am I going to use my money and where am I going to put that money and how am I going to use it in a way that is most beneficial. And so I had to take out loans. And that was an uncomfortable reality, but it was, if I was going to pursue this dream of becoming a physician and an anesthesiologist, that was a reality of it, is taking a loan, but trying to do it in a responsible way so that I could take the money out, but still live in a way that was as minimal as I could. And I guess I lived a minimalism life where I just used the bare resources that were needed to give me happiness and give me a comfortable life. Was a principle that I guess I lived by even before that became a fad. And so I think that having those philosophies in my life just in general sort of set itself up well for me to continue to think about a lot of these strategies long into my career.
Do you mind sharing, you know, how much debt were you in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So my personal debt when I came out of medical school was, I think, $180,000, but you know, through the years that ballooned with interest into $250,000. That was, you know, just taking Fed loans, so the federal loan program at 6.8% interest, which accrues quickly. You know, the power of compound interest is what they say. That's a real thing. It can either work for you or against you, and it can pile up pretty quickly. I'd also absorbed my wife's debt as well too. She went to a very nice medical school, private medical school, and lived lived comfortably. I'll say she lived more comfortably than I did. And that was an extra 500. So we were down $750,000 in student loans, which was a place that I never thought I would be. It's crazy for me to even think that that's what I was in. But yeah, that's the debt that I was starting off at as a new attending.
Wow. Now, how did you guys, did you pay that off? And how did you pay it off?
So yes, I know we were talking about this before, but yes, this is one of the happiest years of my life as we were both able to, get that debt forgiven. And so I would say that, we had a strategy right out from the get-go, and we followed the strategy. And, you know, I think that we were really, really fortunate that everything worked out. So, because I work at a 501c3 organization, meaning a nonprofit hospital, which most academic centers are non-for-profit. My wife works at a non-for-profit hospital as well, too. We were both eligible for public service loan forgiveness. In order to do that, I started paying back my loans early in residency. So as soon as I could start making payments for those loans, I started paying them back. I paid the minimum amount. You should not pay any more than that. I just paid the bare minimum so that it would actually count towards public service loan forgiveness. I had heard about public service loan forgiveness in medical school. It was somewhere in the back of my mind. I didn't really think much about it. I just knew I had to make payments to try to make it happen. It was 10 years worth of payments, which seemed like this distant land far, far away. Couldn't even conceptualize it, but I just made those bare minimum payments anyways. And I honestly wasn't even sure that the program would still be around. I assumed that the program was going to go away, as did a lot of my colleagues. But I had to ask myself, if I'm going to make a bet that a program like that is going to go away, the downside is that it goes away and I owe the same amount of debt that I would have had to pay anyways. The upside is I could potentially get all that stuff forgiven. That's like a lot. That's like getting a lottery ticket with like a 50-50 chance of winning the lottery. Why not take that? So we did that. And, you know, again, I just say that we're really, really fortunate. And yeah, we were able to have that forgiveness repaid. And yeah, it has been a complete game changer.
Now, when you talked about you laid out the plan and you made those minimum payments starting when you were a resident, how user friendly was it to kind of have a plan and make these minimum payments? Because the last thing any resident wants to do is, you know, oh, you got to sign the dotted line, you got to do this. And, oh, if this payment didn't go to this, route it to this account, then it doesn't count. And, you know, did you run into any nuances or anything that just was like, oh, man, if I forgot this, that could have thrown off the whole thing? Like, was there anything like that? Because I personally can't say I trust the government, right? And so it's like, you know, you can have everything done. And then for some reason, how did you navigate that? Like, did you have to get a financial advisor or some kind of tax advisor or some kind of help? Or were you able to do it on your own?
No, absolutely. I'm glad that you brought that up. No. So I did a couple of things to mitigate that risk. Because I, like you, do not trust the government entirely. And so you have to have backup plans for everything. That's really, really important. And so one of those things is, you know, I did have a financial advisor. So during residency, they will oftentimes, you know, host these dinners and they'll give you these advisors. And so, you know, while I have this perpetual suspicion of all individuals that try to take care and try to like look at my money, I also try to take some of their advice. And so we did get a financial advisor early on. And it was the benefit of that was he didn't charge it. He didn't charge us anything. So he would go through our finances, would talk about, you know, how to think about investing in, you know, stocks and bonds and sort of how to think about retirement accounts and thinking about insurance and all these other really important financial vehicles that will set you up well. But didn't take any money. Usually these financial advisors, their business plan is they work with you early when you are a resident with the idea that when you become an attending and you actually start to make attending money income, then they'll start to ask for their money. They'll start to do something called assets under management fees, where they'll basically take a particular cut out of all of your out of all your money and the things that you own in order to continue to be your financial advisor. And so what I did is I leveraged their information and the resources, and I started, particularly toward the end of residency and into fellowship, I used my own resources, like the White Coat Investor, who's a podcaster. He's got his book, he's got YouTube, he's got everything there. And I started to leverage his information, as well as certain tools and apps to sort of learn how to do this on my own, so that I wouldn't have to pay somebody to continue to do this. I was able to do that because I have a particular interest in this. And so I didn't mind continuing to learn about it and try to manage it. But I do think that if you're somebody who doesn't have that interest, I think that with the right kind of advisor, someone who isn't out to sell you a bunch of bad products, it can actually be a really helpful tool, because somebody's got to watch your money. You know, whether you know, one of the things that, that I like to say is that, you know, if you're not watching your money, somebody else is, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, so that's the truth.
You might as well, if you're not going to watch it, you might as well hire somebody that is a certified professional that is trusted, that you know, has got verification, that's got the appropriate licensing that you can actually trust. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of it. Now, the part about public service loan forgiveness, because I didn't necessarily trust a government that was going to stick around, thankfully it did. I had money that I would set aside every single month. I didn't do a lot of this during residency because you just don't have a lot of money. So I would just make the bare minimum payments, which honestly, some of the months were $0. For a lot of the time, it was $0 because I just didn't make enough money. But it's usually not that bad. It's a couple hundred dollars maybe a month, which, you know, I mean, resident salary, I mean, starting off now is like $70,000. If you can't save a couple hundred dollars a month, then you may have to just kind of reevaluate what you're spending your money on. But you know, I had a side fund. So I basically had a side fund that I would invest into a very low risk portfolio so that, you know, if the public service loan forgiveness didn't end up working out and they took it away, well, now I had amassed this large savings that I could dump into for my loans.
Oh,
and because we got our loans forgiven, I was then able to take that money and put it into the down payment for a new house. I think just making sure but you're right though. I think being intentional about not trusting, I think you have to have a certain level of not trust of not trusting these entities that are watching your money. And so making sure that you have plans to enact if these things fall through, I think is a really important part.
Yeah, I like how you safeguarded yourself. And again, as Stephen said, you know, obviously we're not financial advisors. You have to take personal responsibility, right? For the decisions that you make. But, you know, for me as a resident, you know, I had babies during my residency. And so I really did not have the patience or the desire to get into making payments and all of that. So I deferred everything until I became an attending, deferred everything, did not pay a thing. The debt that I had was $350,000. That includes undergrad, medical school. And as you said, that daily compound interest is a very real thing. And so it just always felt like, oh my gosh, this is just moving too slowly. But I was able to pay that off with an attending salary. I worked at Texas Children's for the first 2 years out of training, and I was able to pay off that debt in 2 years.
That's unbelievable.
I went hard.
Laws in and of itself.
Yeah, I went hard with just being like, I've got to get this shackle off my neck. You know, I just got to get it off. I got to get it off. Because often, you know, this debt is what can keep you in a unhappy situation. You know, if you feel like you're doing this because it's like, well, I have to, because I have to pay this debt, then it's like, it doesn't make it fun anymore. Right.
Think about this honestly. Is I look at personal finance, and I look at how you're spending money. It's a wellness issue. It really is a wellness issue, and I don't think that we frame it enough as a wellness issue.
Wow.
If you get yourself into a point where you no longer have, you're no longer burdened with like these like student loan debt, with personal debt through credit cards. And you're in a place where you can actually amass a good amount of savings, a good amount of stable investments, whether that's stock funds, mutual stock bonds, mutual funds, or whether that's particularly real estate, doesn't really matter how you do it. If you can amass that, well, then you can start to open up flexibility in your work and in what you do. And so if you're feeling burned out, if you feel like you need to spend more time on wellness, if you feel like you need to take a day off or two, or take a sabbatical, you're in a financial place that can make that happen. And so I think I think it's honestly a wellness, it's a wellness resiliency part that we don't talk enough about as attendings. And that's, I think, that's a podcast episode in and of itself, that wellness.
Yeah. Now, a question that trainees ask is, should they be buying property?
You know, that's a good question. I think it depends for what. I think what I always say is, are you buying the property as an investment property? Or are you buying it as a place because you want to live there? Mm-hmm. And I would argue that those two places look very, very different. If you're buying a property because you're using it as an investment and you're trying to use it as an investment vehicle, mm-hmm. well, then that's usually going to be a property that is either, number one, in an area that is not so good that you think is going to appreciate significantly in the short term because it's an up-and-coming area. Which is fine, but you have to be willing to live in a place that maybe isn't so desirable. Number two, it may be a place or a home that is not really well kept, and you think that you can put in the work that it needs in order to make it more profitable, which means it's not going to be in a great living condition, but you can take a lot of time, energy, and effort to make it a place that's beautiful and bring it up to value and then be able to sell it. Both of those take a long time, energy, effort, and it's not very desirable. And I think that what a lot of people confuse is buying a property that they just want to live in with buying an investment property. And a lot of times the place that you want to live is not always the best investment, particularly if it's a short-term buy. I think that you definitely see that if it's a short-term buy. I think most resources you'll see out there say you're probably going to take a loss if you're looking to sell within the first 5, maybe 7 years, depending on the location that you're in. And so if you're committed to a particular area for longer than 5 to 7 years, then it may make sense to go out and purchase. The problem is, you know, if you're a medical student or if you're a resident, I mean, your life changes year to year. You just don't know where you're going to end up. If you're not, you know, married with kids, or you're not in a stable place, you don't know where your first job is going to be. I feel like for most of us, our jobs are way too transient to really commit to that. And so I think it's not always the best pure financial decision, in my opinion. I'll add that a lot of people will counter and say, well, I don't want to just throw my money away with rent. The problem with that concept is that you actually throw a lot of money away when you own a home. Some of the effects, so you can, you can calculate this out, but it's a rough estimate. If you take the total amount of money that you bought the property for, we're just going to throw out $1 million, just not that everybody needs to buy $1 million property, but we'll throw $1 million out. Generally, about 5% of that property value every single year, you can't recoup. So about $50,000 a year is just going to be gone. And why is it just going to be gone? Well, you've oftentimes have to pay homeowners association fees. Remember, you got to pay the closing costs, and you got to pay a real estate agent to like look for your property. You're paying for the upkeep of your property. So if something breaks, if something needs to get replaced, if there's damage that happens, water damage, that's all on you that you've got to pay for. There's taxes that you have to pay for every single year, property taxes, state taxes. You're not getting any of that money back. There's mortgage insurance that you're paying for. You're not getting, or mortgage interest rather, you're not getting any of that money back. You might be able to write a little bit off of your taxes, but you're still having to pay that mortgage interest. And so when you add up all those monetary costs, depending on the property that you get, you can actually save a lot of money by just renting. And in fact, me and my wife had a long discussion about this, because I was down to rent forever. I was like, I'm never buying. But at some point it does, I think, become a personal choice. It's a personal choice for stability to buy a place, but I just don't necessarily know if that's the calculus when you are a resident.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm so glad you laid out the details, because my knee-jerk reaction was absolutely not. Absolutely not. You need flexibility. You don't even know if you're going to want to stay in that program. But I'm so glad you laid out those details, because that's a big myth that they needed to be busted. You know, oh, I don't want to throw my money away and rent. And it's like, well, you're not. I just called that out very directly. In residency, you know, you highlighted the key to being minimalistic. And honestly, given how much of a demand of your time residency is going to take, it's almost like you're going to be forced to be minimalistic anyway. You know, have you found that particularly, like, there's something that residents spend too much money on? You know, the cost of eating out is just, it's a lot. It could be a lot. And so it's like, okay, well, then you have to actually go grocery shopping or have somebody go grocery shopping for you and deliver it. And then you got a meal prep. So, I mean, what did that look like for you as you were doing the minimalistic lifestyle?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of adages that I live by, and I'm going to give it another shout out here to the White Coat Investor, Jim Daly, who, you know, I think I've really incorporated a lot of his philosophies into my philosophy after reading his blogs and podcasts for years and years. But I think one of the things that he mentions that's really important is that, you know, as physicians, even as residents, where you're making more than the average salary for a U.S. household family, got to remember that. So we actually are making a lot of money even during residency. But then after, you know, you can have anything you want. You just can't have everything, meaning that whatever it is that you want to spend money on, you can do that one thing, maybe two, but you can't have it all. So for me, I really enjoy traveling. I think travel is a real good way for me to reset my mind. I love seeing new things. I love seeing places. And so even during residency, I was able to travel. Maybe I didn't go to Europe or anything like that, but I was able to travel a decent amount. And, you know, that's expensive. And so I did that at the expense of having a really, really nice place. I'd say my place wasn't horrible, but it definitely wasn't nice. I would say I was in a small studio, that's all I had. And so, I wasn't shopping at Whole Foods every day. I just had my little local shopping mart and I would just eat there. You know, I wasn't wearing like the most expensive stuff. I didn't have a nice car. I had my Honda Civic, which I still have today. It's 2013 Honda Civic. The thing runs like a tank. It's still going. And so you can have anything you want. You just can't have everything, meaning you have to really think about what it is that's going to provide you the most return on your investment in terms of your happiness, your well-being, what's going to be best for you and your family, and spend money on that. And so that was sort of the philosophy that I lived by.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful. And that really does require introspection. It does require you spending time really answering those questions. I think it's very easy for people to, you know, look online and say, okay, well, what am I supposed to do? But as you've already highlighted, that's very nuanced and it's very personalized. And so you can't work around doing that deep dive.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Estime. Is there anything that you want to share that you didn't get the opportunity to?
Want to thank you for inviting me on the podcast. People can, if they want to connect with me, they can follow me on Twitter. That's probably where I share the majority of my information. I don't really share it anywhere else, but that's just my last name, MD. So Estimate MD, at Twitter. But outside of that, no, I think we went through everything. And, you know, if anybody has questions about this, or if they want more information, feel free to reach out to me. I try to avail myself to really any and everybody that listens.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of SIVO Sisters. If you love this episode as much as I did, head on over and rate and subscribe so you don't miss out. New episodes drop every week on a Monday because we all can use a little something to get us through the week. Am I right? I'd love to hear more from you on the topics that you want to hear. So let me know in the comments. This is Dr. Peterson signing off. See you next time.